Hello, Roy here. I just wanted to let you know that you can listen to The Roy Green Show ad-free on Amazon Music, included with Prime.
Welcome to The Roy Green Show podcast.
One of the most important issues that Canadians are facing, and is becoming more significant, more so than we perhaps anticipated, is the issue of food. And the ability of Canadians to feed themselves. The cost is an incredible factor. And we're now at a time in Canada where almost 25% of our population, one of four, is dealing with some level of food insecurity. We're going to get into that issue a little later on. But we're going to begin with a study that was just released from Dalhousie University, from the Agri-Foods Laboratory, and a study which shows almost 60% of Canadians regularly eat food that's beyond its best before date. 23% do this constantly. Among millennials, 41% believe they've become ill after eating potentially unsafe food products in the past year. And there's another major issue here, but I think there's this theory in Canada that food somehow just magically appears on the shelf. These are companies, corporations that operate the food stores, move the food, buy it wholesale, sell it retail. It's a business. And business is not bad, and corporations are not evil, regardless of what Mr. Singh may continually preach at you. And if our food corporations, if our food supply is threatened, if it becomes a challenging reality for the food sector, and it has, you and I and everyone else in this country are going to feel it. We're joined by our good friend, Professor Sylvain Charlebois, director of the Dalhousie University Agri-Foods Laboratory. They're the ones that put out this study with these numbers we're talking about. Sylvain, thank you very much. 60% of Canadians regularly eating food beyond its best before date. You and I first talked about this about a year ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, the actual number is 58%. I mean, there is a silver lining here. People are likely wasting less food, basically. And I think people are starting to understand what these best before dates are all about. They are arbitrary, really. They're set by the industry, enticing us to eat a food product at its optimal state, because obviously they want our business back, so they want to make sure that we're eating their product when it's fresh, when it's ideal. But at the same time, while people are wasting less, they may be risking more. That's the thing. And of course, in our study, we did ask specifically whether or not people were pushing the envelope a little bit and were enticed to actually consume these products because food prices are higher right now. And so you can see that a lot of people are under a lot of pressure, especially the younger generations. You can see that numbers are much higher for millennials and Gen Zs in particular.
Mm-hmm. As I said a couple of minutes ago in the introduction, millennials, 41% of millennials, you and I both have something stuck in our throats, 41%
<That's right.
laughs> of millennials believe they have become ill after eating potentially unsafe food products, and that's in the last year. That's a lot of people, and I would imagine a lot of that has to do with financial, as you just said, the financial pressures on young people.
That's right. And of course, we're all concerned about that because health costs outweigh any food products you would want to throw away. So I think essentially, Roy, the one message I'm getting from our recent study is that we've all become different risk managers at home, basically, especially when it comes to food safety. And I've always believed that no matter what the CFIA does, regardless of what provinces do, municipalities to keep our food safe, and they do keep our food safe. Canada is actually one of the best performing countries in the world. Some people may not believe that, but if you actually look at the data, we're actually doing very well. But at the end of the day, consumers are responsible. They're the ones really that do play a very significant role when managing risk and keeping the number of people falling ill as low as possible.
Yeah, I've tried to have a conversation with people from time to time about the whole idea of where food comes from, how it gets on the shelf, and who runs the companies. They don't want to talk about it. People just don't want to talk about it. And when I make the case that it's really it's business, but it's a business with a responsibility quotient that's been questioned and investigated. But in this study of yours that you just released, I see that Canada's food sector, maybe we should define what the food sector is falling behind the United States in wholesale and industrial prices. So what is the food sector, Sylvain, and what does this mean to the consumer if we're falling behind the U.S. in wholesale and industrial prices? What does that mean?
That's a great question, and this is why you and I, we've had many chats about our industry's competitiveness. And when we talk about the food industry, of course, it's from farm gate to plate. So farmers, processors, transportation companies, distributors, wholesalers, agents, brokers, everyone involved with our food. And the competitiveness of our industry is quite critical, especially when it comes to food safety. I mean, the worst business model is to poison people. No agri-food business. I actually firmly believe that there are no agri-businesses out there wanting to poison people. It's just not good for business. So obviously, but mistakes do happen, and mistakes will happen if they are oversights, lack of resources, lack of focus, and that's why you need a competitive industry. But right now, when you actually compare Canada's data with wholesale industrial prices, for example, the financial pressures that a lot of companies are under here in Canada versus the U.S., I mean, that gap is really increasing between the two countries. On the one side, in the United States, the economy is boiling. You saw numbers coming out last week. I mean, they are seriously talking about increasing interest rates in the U.S., and that's going to put even more pressure on Canada. So that gap is absolutely growing, and that's why I think it's important to focus on making sure that our agri-food sector remains as competitive as possible and avoid implementing policies. And, of course, I'm referring to the carbon tax or the carbon pricing policy specifically. Implementing some of these policies just only hurt businesses.
Now, you also, on your X feed today, at Food Professor, I looked at this. This one caught my eye. So we're falling behind the United States on the issue of wholesale and industrial prices, and you just explained that to us. But you also raised the specter, the potential specter, of companies saying, well, we just can't function in this country with federal regulations and let's call it the enthusiasm of the current government for the carbon tax. So we'll just pack up and move, maybe to the United States, where things are fiscally more manageable, and they'll welcome us with open arms. How much of a danger is that?
Oh, it's significant. And for people who may not understand what that means, people may think, well, who cares? If they move to the United States, they'll just sell their products to Canada. It's just a different location. Well, there's a border, a different currency, different climates. You see, Roy, the more you expand your global supply chain or your supply chain, the more likely you're exposing the entire system to factors that can absolutely impact the entire system, including food prices at retail. We saw that with Ukraine. We saw that with supply chains and COVID. And the more you increase risks, the more likely you'll see prices fluctuate. And that's exactly what's going on in two areas in Canada right now because of bad policies. That would be here in the Maritimes, where there's no processing. A lot of it actually happens outside our region. And BC right now, which is really hurting when it comes to manufacturing, policies are there to support small farms, small-scale operations. So the big players are just investing in Alberta and Washington State. They just don't want to do business in BC. And that could happen across the country if we're continuing on the path we're on right now.
And that would be reflected in pricing on the grocery shelves, right? And if our food companies, the ones that we have in this country now, if they were to say collectively, or a number of them, it's just impossible for us to operate in this Canada with its regulations and its enthusiasm for the carbon tax, so we're out of here. We would then be buying our food from our companies, but wholesaling them out of the United States back to us now. Yeah?
Absolutely. One concrete example of how manufacturing is so critical close to a market. Recently, in BC, we saw one company decide to go to Alberta because they couldn't find land, affordable land. They couldn't find a regime to support their model. So they went to Alberta to actually process poultry. Guess what, Roy? Right now, poultry prices in BC are anywhere between 25 to 30% more expensive than the national average in BC right now. So our friends out of BC are paying 25 to 30% for their whole chicken, drumsticks, chicken breasts, you name it, just because BC didn't think about implementing business-friendly policies to encourage investments, not discouraging it.
Wow. So our listeners in Kamloops, Kelowna, and Vancouver are shuddering right now. This probably isn't the best time for me to introduce the issue of the avian flu. We'll hold on to that for a second.
I would like to remind the colleague opposite that in the Ag Committee last week, one of Canada's foremost expert on food policy, Sylvain Charlebois from Dalhousie University, said, and I quote, Madam Speaker, we don't see the evidence of that, talking about the impact of carbon pricing on food in Canada. He, and actually, they invited him to speak at the Ag Committee, Madam Speaker, so I think we have it here.
He's quoting you.
Yes, he is, but he wasn't reading his notes. He should have, because I never said that.
Have you heard from the minister yet?
No, I have not, unfortunately.
Okay.
He has mentioned my name a few times, but no, he has not apologized. And frankly, Roy, I don't expect anything. Frankly, I think that Minister Guilbeault is dealing with a lot of issues right now, and whether it's plastics or carbon pricing, he's out there to save the world. So I don't want to get in the way, really. Would you want me to do that, Roy?
Yes. Yes, I would. Absolutely. That's why I keep playing that clip for you. Just to nudge you. I'm like the tugboat. I want to nudge you in the proper direction.
I'm pleased with what's going on right now with carbon pricing in particular because...
Yeah, let's talk about that, Sylvain. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that over the last 5 to 7 years, Canada was sleepwalking through carbon pricing policies without really asking tough questions. And what I'm hearing right now, both from media and Canadians, are tough questions. So what are we doing with carbon pricing? Why not consider opportunities with natural gas? Are we measuring the impact of carbon pricing on the environment? And so now if we're giving back money to businesses and Canadians, so what is the purpose of this particular policy? And you spoke about Saskatchewan earlier. I mean, we learned this week that in Saskatchewan, the government is not collecting any carbon tax anymore since, I believe, earlier this year. But people will still get their rebate. So
yeah, that's for home. That's for heating. That's for heating products. They're not collecting the carbon tax on heating products.
That's right. Same as the Atlantic, basically. Right. And so I do believe that there's a lot of confusion out there and a lot of breaches in the spirit of the policy itself, which is often undermined by the government right now, the government that's in office right now. Mm-hmm. And so I am pretty pleased with what's going on right now, because I think that's probably why Liberals are down in the polls, because so far a lot of Canadians wanted to support an environmental policy, but more and more we're starting to figure out that it's not really an environmental policy. It's more about wealth distribution, or really, well, good politics, but bad policy.
Yeah, Daryl Bricker from Ipsos told us that the carbon tax is to the Liberals what the GST was to the Mulroney Progressive Conservatives in the early 90s. This is just a virtual replay.
The GST, there was a purpose.
Well, I guess, yes, there was.
The recognized that they couldn't scrap it either, and now everyone understands the spirit behind the GST.
Yeah.
But the carbon tax, nobody really understands why it is there, and is it effective?
The issue of anti-Semitism in this country is, and I called it yesterday, Jew hatred, because that's what it is. It's so utterly disturbing and utterly unacceptable that we can't sit by and say nothing and do nothing. We cannot do that. So we will follow up, and we will talk to people who are specifically and directly involved. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by David Sachs. He's from the Jewish Federation of Ottawa. And when Mr. Sachs was leaving a Muslim-Jewish interfaith event on Parliament Hill, he was identified as Jewish by pro-Palestinian and pro-Hamas demonstrators, and he was swarmed, requiring a police escort to leave the area. We'll talk to Mr. Sachs in a few minutes' time. But first joining us is the deputy leader of the Conservative Party and member of Parliament in the Toronto area. She's Jewish. Melissa Lantzman is with us. Melissa, thank you for coming on the program. How are you doing?
Thanks for having me again.
So when I say Jew hatred in this country, how do you respond?
Oh, it's exactly what it is. And you've seen an uptick since days after October 7th. And it is getting worse and worse. And I think there is an abdication of leadership on every politician at every level of government who is in power to put a stop to this. It is out of control.
Yeah. And at our post-secondary education institutions, also known as universities and colleges, it's a huge problem, a huge issue there. In the United States, they have the police now moving in and making arrests. That hasn't really happened in this country. But would you address that issue of anti-Semitism or Jew hatred at our universities?
Yeah, look, what an absolute embarrassment it is for our institutions that are world-renowned with leadership in those universities who have ostensibly done nothing, sat by and watched until, of course, the tent encampments that have started here, at least in the province of Quebec, which will follow suit. When you give somebody an inch, they will take a mile. We've seen people on the steps of, you know, Vancouver's art gallery and right in front of Parliament Hill calling October 7th a win, glamorizing and glorifying terrorism. And we've effectively had leadership, particularly at the federal level, that has chosen the wrong side of history and that has made this commonplace in Canada.
So Hamas is declared a terrorist organization by the federal government of Canada. And to support Hamas openly, as has been done and quite vociferously in this country, if I'm not mistaken, that's a criminal offense.
It certainly is. We don't have a law problem here. We have an enforcement problem. We have a leadership problem. We have those who should be on our watch list, certainly banned as terrorist organizations, people of charitable status in this country, like a group called Sammy Doon, connected to the PLFP, a terrorist organization. We have the IRGC, the Iranian-backed regime's army that openly recruits and raises money and organizes here. We have a known 700 agents here that are terrorizing communities. This is not simply about Hamas. It is a war on the West. It is a war on civilization. And I cannot believe that the government of Canada has taken the wrong side in this war.
You're Jewish Canadian. What's going on? What are people telling you? What are your family members? What are your friends telling you within the Jewish community about how they feel today?
You know, I represent the largest community, but there are communities all over Toronto and Vancouver and Montreal and everywhere in between, and they're all saying the same thing. First of all, they cannot believe that it's gotten to this point. Some of them are afraid to go to school, to go to synagogues, to go to community centers, because those too have been targets of shootings and firebombings and outright intimidation on the front steps. Look, I have to say, this is a problem that starts with the Jews in a country, never ends with the Jews in the country. And it is a symptom of something much, much larger. And I think if the government doesn't act, we're in really, really big trouble here of all of the values of freedom, of democracy, of the rule of law that we support in this country are at risk.
So we have three levels of government in Canada: municipal, provincial, and federal. And each has different levels of responsibility in managing the affairs of either a city, a province, or the nation. If the Conservative Party wins the next federal election, and it looks as though you're going to walk away with it, if that comes true, and you're the Deputy Prime Minister, I'm assuming that would be the case, what would you be able to do? What would you expect your party to do about this Jew hatred if you form a majority government?
Look, I think there are a number of things that we can do, but it starts from where you started this conversation. One, it starts with Canada's relationship with Israel. It has never been this bad. It will not be this bad after Justin Trudeau leaves. This is an anomaly in a deep 75-year history. I think leadership and tone comes from the top. And if Canadians were assured that their leaders protected, were in this to protect Canadian values, then we would see much different behavior from the police, who don't feel like they have the backing of politicians at any level of government. We have municipal politicians that have marched in parades against the police in this country, and not just in one city. We have a provincial government, at least in the province of Ontario, that is basically in the witness protection program. They have said nothing. They have done nothing. In fact, they've exacerbated the situation. And we have a prime minister that has absolutely turned his back on a long-standing democratic ally. All of those things can change with leadership from the top.
You had an encounter with Prime Minister Trudeau in February of 22, when the issue came up about being Jewish in this country and what had gone on nationally. And you challenged Mr. Trudeau, and if I have this correctly, if I remember correctly, he looked at you and said, "You're a party, Conservative Party," and he looked at you, Jewish member of Parliament, Jewish Canadian. He looked at you and said the Conservative Party, quote, "is standing with people who wave swastikas," end quote. And he didn't apologize that day. He left Parliament, or left a question period, without apologizing. Has he ever done that? Has he ever apologized for that?
No, I'm still waiting by my phone for an apology. But I will say this about the Prime Minister. I will never take lessons from a Prime Minister who has a minister who literally caresses the hand of a terrorist, Mahmoud Abbas, both the foreign minister and the minister for mental health. Her name is Yara Sachs, who represents a lot of Jews in her riding. I will never take lessons from a prime minister whose deputy prime minister couldn't just last week denounce "Long Live October 7th as a problematic statement, let alone a hateful one. And I will never take lessons from a prime minister that lets the wannabe jihadists run with their face covered in front of Parliament Hill, that intimidate both Jews and Canadians writ large in our place of democracy. That is not a prime minister I will ever support, and it is not a prime minister that I will ever expect an apology from.
let's get back to the issue of what we're calling Jew hatred in this country. David Sachs joins us from the Jewish Federation of Ottawa. David, thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm good, thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Roy.
You were at an interfaith, Muslim-Jewish interfaith event on Parliament Hill. Tell us what happened as you left, please.
Of course. It wasn't exactly a Muslim-Jewish interfaith. It was a Muslim friendship dinner, and it invited a lot of groups, including the Jewish community, including many of our police forces, including representatives of the universities, other religious groups, and politicians. So it's a very beautiful event, which I've been honored to attend for the last several years, marking Ramadan. And because of the presence of the prime minister and the mayor and other politicians, I'm imagining this is the reason, there was a number of protesters in front of the event, masked in keffiyehs and screaming and harassing the politicians and the guests who were coming to the event. And they've actually posted this on their Instagram account. They're proud of this harassment that they give to people. But what they didn't post is what they did to me, which is that when I came out of the event, and I believe that I was the only visibly Jewish man to leave the event by the main door, and I've spoken with the organizers, and they say no one else had this kind of experience. But I was immediately swarmed by 6, 7, 8 keffiyeh-masked protesters who came right up, surrounding me, pressing against me, shoving me, screaming in my face, screaming with absolute rage, swearing, saying, the worst kind of accusations, insults, threats that you can imagine. One of them had a marching drum with a Palestinian flag on it that he brought up into my face and was banging in my face. Another woman had a kind of a noise weapon that I've never seen before that she had right in my face, blasting some kind of a sound that was quite painful, to the point where a police officer had to leave the event and come to separate myself, but he could only stand by one side. So I was surrounded on three sides by these people who walked with me, and the police officer kept asking me to please just keep walking, and he walked with me for 4 long blocks while they were pressed in against me, screaming in my face, blasting the noisemaker in my face. So it was not an experience I would like to see anyone in my community have. I think for myself, it's easy to let it go, but I try and think in my role working for the community, if I heard about that happening to anybody else in my community, I would be incensed. And I think that it's time that Canadians realize this is the behavior and this is the hatred that is emanating from the anti-Israel movement. And this is also the context that Jewish Canadians are now living in. That just to leave the house and be visibly Jewish is to take a risk that something like this could happen to you, and it could happen in a place where there are no police to intervene.
So nobody listening to this could possibly not have empathy for what you experienced and have great concern. But you also deal with the issue of anti-Semitism, and you do so publicly. You advise people on how to address anti-Semitism. So here you are, exposed to and the worst kind of anti-Semitism, and it's focused directly at you. What do you do, David? What's the approach we should be taking in this country to address the anti-Semitism that we're so clearly aware of now, and you have just explain to us on a very personal level.
That's a great and big question. And I think it starts with understanding anti-Semitism, because we have a great hurdle to overcome, which is that the vast majority of Canadians aren't aware of anti-Semitism, don't necessarily care about anti-Semitism because they don't really understand the human cost that is entailed. And I'm going to say something which might be a little bit shocking to listeners, but which I can back up, which is that anti-Semitism is a fundamental piece of the fabric of Western civilization. It is baked into our culture for 1,700 years at least. And for 1,700 years, we have had expulsions, genocides, and humiliations perpetrated against Jews in every single region of Europe, in every single century for the last 1,700 years. So, I mean, that is embedded. It is part of our society and very long-lived. People need to understand that today that manifests in hatred towards Jews that people are unaware of. Jews are the number one target per capita of hate crimes in Canada, the United States, France, and Great Britain every single year. And the only thing that's changed with the current wave is that we're now the number one target of hate in pure absolute numbers. So 1.5% of the Ottawa population is Jewish, but 27% of hate crimes are directed against the Ottawa Jewish population. So people need to understand the extent that anti-Semitism is a part of our culture, the extent that we ignore it, because the most common prejudice that's built into our unconscious is that Jews are privileged and Jews are part of the power structure. So we don't think, even if we don't think of ourselves as being anti-Jewish or of harboring any resentment towards Jewish, we all have that kind of built into our subconscious. Jews don't need protecting. Jews don't need us to worry about them. And so you see that Jews have been completely left out and failed by all the equity and EDI industry because we're not considered a group that needs support, even though we're the number one target of hate crimes. So the most important thing is an attitude shift. That people need to come to grips with the idea that Jews are and have been, for all recorded history, a targeted minority, and that there was a blip of acceptance for the last 50 or 60 years, and that blip has diminished, and we've gone back to what are more historic norms.
Yeah. We only have a few seconds, but I want to say this to you, and I had this thought after you and I spoke on the phone the other day. And I've had it as I've prepared for different programs, and the word anti-Semitism comes up again and again and again. And I don't know how easily that word rolls off people's tongues. I don't know how easily or understandable that is. Whereas when I say Jew hatred, that resonates because there's no mistaking what those two words, hyphenated, mean and what they really not just suggest, what they define. David, thank you very much for joining us. I hope you'll come back.
And I agree with you, Roy. I think that's a great point.
Yeah, we'll have you back. Thank you, David. Appreciate it. Thanks
so
much.
Thank you so much.
We today have made a formal request to Health Canada to amend the exemption to the Controlled Drugs and Substances Act, which will give the police the tools they need to enforce the law anytime someone is using drugs in an inappropriate location and compromising public safety.
There's only one way to characterize what you just heard David Eby, the premier of British Columbia, say. It's a retreat. It's a retreat from the policy they have had in place for 1 year. It's a three-year policy, and that was to allow for people with addictions, drug addictions, to obtain up to 2.5 milligrams of personal illicit drugs, fentanyl, cocaine, heroin, and the list goes on. And it's been an issue. It's been a challenge. And it hasn't gone well because the drugs have been consumed in very public places. We spoke last weekend with the president of the British Columbia Nurses Association and heard about drug use in hospitals, particularly in northern British Columbia, and fentanyl smoke drifting into different departments in the hospital, and nurses being told, if you see anything, don't report it, and violence, and it's just been a very challenging situation, and the people of British Columbia have spoken up, and now the premier has backed down. At least that's how I interpret it. The program itself, how useful might it have been? How useful was it as far as its definition was concerned? Let's talk to a good friend of our programs, Dr. Brian Conway, Medical Director and Infectious Diseases Specialist at the Vancouver Infectious Diseases Center on the east side of Vancouver. Dr. Conway, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me back, Roy.
How do you react to the premier's decision?
Well, it's a program that was poorly conceived, poorly rolled out, and poorly applied. So I think those are fatal flaws that led to the necessary conclusion that you need to retreat, at least temporarily, understand what happened, understand if it can be done better. And the next few weeks will be key in us having that dialogue and tracing a way forward for all of us, for all British Columbians. But right now, this was an absolutely necessary decision.
Is there a way back, or has the situation become so compromised that any reintroduction of the system, even if it's modified, is going to be looked at with some significant degree of suspicion?
Well, I think we'll need to explain to British Columbians what we mean to do if the program is reintroduced. What should have happened is from the get-go to immediately hire all of the police, which was done, all of the support workers, which was not done, to really support the application of the program, identify in the first weeks, if not days, individuals that were positively helped by the program, and publicize the fact that it is because of the program that they are enjoying a better outcome in their day-to-day lives. And that was never, ever done. It devolved into a cat-and-mouse game where people tried to sort of have exactly right up to the limit, the 2.5 grams that they have, to avoid the possibility of legal entanglement. They pushed the limit in terms of where they were allowed to use. The premier tried to backtrack, and the head of the appeals court told him that he couldn't. So it was just failure after failure after failure. So if we go forward, we're going to have to do it in a very clear and transparent way and show within days to weeks that it's succeeding. Outside of that, it won't work.
So do I hear you saying that, Dr. Conway, that you think it's worthwhile to do it again, to do a do-over, and then change the dynamics and report to British Columbians what's going on, when British Columbians in many cases are going to be saying, well, hang on, I had people who were addicted leaving their needles in my child's schoolyard or playground, or had them in my backyard, or it's tough to recover from this. But you think it's the inception of the program was correct? It's the rollout that was wrong.
Oh, the rollout was flawed in every possible way. I think people have to be very convincing to say our goal, our primary objective, is that all British Columbians feel safe everywhere in British Columbia, and this is exactly how we're going to do it. We're going to empower the authorities to intervene if safety is compromised in any way. If people are using too near to children, if people are leaving needles around in public so they could be found by children, if people are using in a disruptive way, this will absolutely not be tolerated. There'll be zero tolerance. On the other hand, these are people that are vulnerable, the people that need help. They don't need to go to jail, they need help. So here are three or four or five examples this week alone where we interacted with people, we brought them into care in a way that made sense to them and made sense to us, and we're already seeing positive results. So let's give this thing a chance. That's what needs to happen. It's a very tall order. It's not obvious that everyone will cooperate. The people who use drugs on the street are very much viewing this as a lack of confidence in their ability to do anything. And we need to really say that it's not us and them, it's us and us. We're trying to make BC a better place and make you part of it. Can we work together on that? So it's a tall order. I'm not saying it's obvious. It's not like a two-week timeout and let's go back to the way it was. It's a radical change, and it's possible, but it's difficult.
Do you interpret this as the premier recriminalizing the drugs?
Oh, not at all. Basically, what he's saying is that the way in which drugs are being used is unsafe to many British Columbians. You can't be sitting there with your two kids in high chairs at Tim Hortons and have someone sit down next to you and pull out a rig, pull out a tourniquet, and start injecting fentanyl. That can't be allowed. There's no way that this is allowed. Your kids can't be walking home from school, and right next to the schoolyard, someone is against the fence shooting up or using drugs. You can't have a nurse in a hospital walk in and say, I'm here to give you medical care, and be told by an individual, come back later, I'm smoking fentanyl. This is silly. And that's kind of where it went. And that's what really needs to end. And I think we didn't do it right. And if we're going to do it again, we need to do it right.
Professor Sylvain Charlebois started this program today. The director of the Dalhousie University Agri-Foods Laboratory, and the report they just released, study shows that 60% of Canadians regularly eat food beyond its best before date. Millennials, 41%, believe they have become ill after eating potentially unsafe food products in the past year, but they spent the money on what they could afford. And it was often food that was right at the end of its best before time and maybe kept it around for a while. And, he also said Canada's food sector is falling behind that of the United States. And there is the chance, a good chance, that Canadian firms will just say, we can't survive here. We just can't make it. With the way the government is running things, particularly the carbon tax. And there's nothing that forces them to stay in this country. They're not criminals, although Jagmeet Singh may want you to believe that they're sort of one foot in and one foot out of the out of that definition. That's just not true. I'd like to speak with Mr. Singh about that. We'll ask him to do it. But I said there were going to be two parts on the food issue, food situation, food. It's a crisis in Canada. It's huge. I had no idea, and we've talked about it a lot, I had no idea we were going to be hearing what we've heard over the last couple of days. No idea. A report released on Friday by StatsCan, this will blow you away, and I know there are people listening to this program right now, I know it, who are caught up in this. 8.7 million Canadians. That would instantly be the biggest city in the country. If you took 8.7 million people and placed them on the ground and built a city around them, that would instantly be the largest city in Canada. 8.7 million Canadians, or 22.9% of our national population, has reported some level of food insecurity. The most recent numbers that are available from StatsCan are 2022. I don't think there's any reason to believe it's improved. 8.7 million Canadians, 22.9% of the national population, have reported some level of food insecurity in 2022. Now wait, it gets worse. That's an increase of almost 1.8 million people from the previous year. An increase of almost 1.8 million people from the previous year. We're joined by Professor Valerie Tarasuk, the lead investigator of the University of Toronto's Household Food Insecurity Research Program. It's known as PROOF, and we've spoken with Professor Tarasuk on a number of occasions about this very, very disturbing, hugely disturbing reality. Professor Tarasuk, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
It's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
8.7 million people out of a population of 40 million.
Yeah.
How do we get to this place?
You know, I mean, this is a problem that's been festering for a long time, right? Like, honestly, PROOF has been tracking these numbers for years now, and each year the number has gone up. And I should just clarify one thing. Well, the year on this survey is 2022. The survey interviews that gave us that horrible number of 8.7 or 8.69 million. The interviews were actually conducted between January and June of 2023.
Oh, wow.
So it's important, right? Because what we've seen over the last couple of years is really, really dramatic inflation in costs of food and shelter, fuel, you know, basic necessities. And so I think part of the explanation for the very dramatic increase that we're reporting now is the increase in costs, basic costs of living. And, you know, we've got a fairly substantial number of people in the country who have been unable to manage those costs. And that's what that hideous number of 8.69 million is telling us.
Mm-hmm. Statistics Canada did measure this food insecurity. They had three categories they used. One was marginal, the second was moderate, and the third was severe. What are they? What's the difference between them?
Yeah. Well, it's a good question. So the questions that ascertain household food insecurity status, there are 18 of them, and they range in severity from worrying about running out of food and not having more, through to some questions about quality. So not being able to feed yourself or your children a balanced meal because of a lack of money for food. And then a whole bunch of questions about quantitative deprivation. So skipping meals, cutting the size of meals, and at its most extreme, going whole days without eating, all because of a lack of money for food. So the marginal category of food insecurity are people who said yes to one question of the 18. And that's most likely to be the worry question, but it might also be a question about the quality of food being compromised. What's really upsetting about the new numbers that we've got is that the bulk of the increase is not the marginal category. It's the moderate and severe groups. So the moderately food insecure, of which we now have 3.3 million people living in those, 4.135 million people living in those conditions now, moderately food insecure. They are households that have reported some compromise in quality and possibly among some members, a compromise in the amount of food. The most disturbing finding for me on this whole story is the increase in the number of people living in severely food insecure households. We've got 2.29 million of those people. And that means, Roy, that they're in households that have reported at some point over the prior 12 months actually having not enough to eat. Now, that doesn't mean that children in those households have gone hungry necessarily, but it means that somebody, most likely adults, have been compromising the amount of food that they're eating because of a lack of money for food. So these are substantial levels of deprivation. It's not just about somebody thinking, you know, gee whiz, the price of, milk has gone up. I better, you know, cut back on my milk consumption. It's not that. This is people, especially at the bottom end, really, really struggling to afford the food they need.
Do I have this correctly, that in the severe category, there are people who are telling the folks who are asking the questions, they're saying they've gone days without food because they can't afford it?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's too early for me to know how many are in that category. I mean, that's the worst case scenario. And so it's always the smallest number,
right,
that report that. And remember, these are interviews with people who are housed. So,
oh my, yes, know, yes,
there
yes,
would
yes.
be people in much worse situations that we're not picking up. I also should say that these numbers only include people in the 10 provinces. We haven't got the territories in here, and we haven't got people living in First Nations reserves or First Nations communities. And so there may be people in much worse circumstances. Unquestionably, people without stable housing will be way more likely to be in that severe category. But yeah, it's too early to know what the percentage is. It will be small, but it still will be way too higher than it should be.
This is Canada.
Yeah.
First exactly. world nation, G7 nation. It's intolerable. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's going to change in the short term? Are you hopeful?
No. I mean, we're talking about data that were collected in 2023.
Right.
And if you think about what's going on right now in 2024, we haven't seen prices fall. So then the question is, well, what's happened to incomes? Have we got more income supports on the table to help people manage these increasing prices? And in some jurisdictions we do, right? I mean, Newfoundland and Labrador came out with a very, very progressive poverty reduction strategy a few months back, and that included something like a 300% increase in the provincial child benefit. So, you know, in places like Newfoundland and Labrador, I think we can expect these numbers to hold steady or maybe even dip. But in other places like Ontario, I don't think that's what we should be expecting, unless there's been some concerted action to improve incomes of people at the bottom end, or, you know, something else, an increase in employment and, you know, number of hours available to work. Unless there's something else that's changing, the situation isn't going to change.
Yeah. Food banks, you've told us before, are not the answer, even though food banks are recording again record usage of their resources.
Right. Yeah. Well, and I think, like, when these numbers came out on Friday, we started to hear from people who are operating food banks across the country. And I think for them, these numbers resonate, right? They are seeing people lined up around the block. I heard somebody interviewed who was leads a food bank in Nova Scotia, or the large Feed Nova Scotia Association. And he said people come like an hour or two before the place even opens, just to make sure that they're, you know, have a good spot in line to get the best, I guess, of what's on offer. So, you know, at the community level, this problem has been playing out for months now. And so we've just now got a set of numbers that confirm that, in fact, we've got a growing number of people in our communities that can't manage.
Dr. Tarasuk, thank you. Thank you for taking the time. I really was hoping the news would be better after the last time you and I spoke, but thank you so much.
Well, thanks for your interest in this. I mean, part of the way these things change is that we shine a light on them, right? So
yeah,
thank you,
Roy,
for taking this on.
I'll continue to do that. Thank you again.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you want to hear more, subscribe to The Roy Green Show on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorites. And if you like what you hear, leave us a review and tell a friend. I'm Roy Green. Have a great weekend.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.